Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
And welcome to Research on Religion. I've been expecting you.
All right. Enough with the cheesy horror movie sound effects. We have some serious business to conduct here. We're about a week away from Halloween, and just like last year when we featured a discussion on Bigfoot, haunted houses, and UFO cults, I thought we'd take another look at the spookier side of the supernatural. And so today we've invited Professor Scott Poole to talk with us about his new book, Monsters in America, Our Historical Obsession with the Hideous and the Haunting, released by Baylor University Press. I had to mention that this book is published by Baylor just in case the good folks at Baylor who sponsor this podcast say, "Hey, what are you talking about monsters for on this program dealing with religion?" I guess my response would be, "Hey, it's your publishing house." Now, I gotta admit, the folks at Baylor's Institute for the Studies of Religion are very good to me in allowing me to independently choose my topics and guests, for which I bear full responsibility. And for that, I want to cheer them on and encourage you to visit their website at www.isreligion.org. Now, getting back to our topic, my guest today, Scott Poole, is a professor of history at the College of Charleston and the author of numerous articles and 6 books, including Satan in America, The Devil We Know, Never Surrender, Confederate Memory and Conservatism in South Carolina Upcountry, and Veil of Tears, New Essays in Religion and Reconstruction. Scott is also a regular contributor to the blog Pop Matters, which is located at www.popmatters.com. We will post links to all these items on our website, as is our usual practice. And also, a quick note of caution to our regular listeners that this episode is likely to be a bit more macabre than other episodes, not only in its portrayal of monsters, but in its perspective on U.S. history as well. You have been forewarned, so proceed at your own risk. Scott, welcome to Research on Religion.
Good morning, Tony. Thanks very much for having me on. And can I say, I'd actually love to hear some more cheesy horror effects. That was great.
Oh, well, you know, that's good. I've worked on those all week and
I bet.
Putting them in there.
Good.
So, and you know, that it reminds me because I was reading your book jacket biography and finding out a little bit more about you as we do this website so I can give you a good introduction. And you have an interest in, or at least when you were growing up, had a big interest in monsters. And I was the same way, too. I remember every Saturday morning I'd get up and I'd go down and watch Monster Horror Chiller Theater or whatever it was
called. Right, right. It was shock theater for me.
Yeah. Actually, Monster Horror Chiller Theater is, I couldn't remember what mine was called, but for those of you who lived through my era, that's a reference to Second City Television with Count Floyd, who always had these cheesy monster films on, and that was hilarious for me. My favorite monster movies were always the radioactive big creatures like Godzilla and Mothra.
More sort of 1950s kind of.
Yeah. They were always reruns. So it's the 1950s to 60s, and you know, I loved it when Mothra and Godzilla would team up against some creature from outer space, because the other thing that I really loved were the outer space monsters. And I have to admit, one of my favorite movies of all time, or at least favorite monster movies, was The Creature from the Black Lagoon. So I did have some...
Oh, yeah, I love that one.
Yeah.
Actually, I'm right there with you. I actually just saw that again very recently after having not seen it for a while and really, really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I got to go back and do that. I was wondering, do you have any favorite genre of monster movies or anything like that?
You know, for me, it's you know, I'm really conflicted in some ways because, in a sense, my favorite era is sort of the golden era of Universal Studios monsters. So Frankenstein, Dracula, particularly The Bride of Frankenstein, which is at least in the running for my favorite horror movie. I mean, it made a when I was 8 and first saw that on a lazy Saturday afternoon watching Shock Theater on my parents' gigantic console TV in the late 70s. That just made a, Bride of Frankenstein made a huge impression on me. I got to say, though, I also sort of came of age. I was a teenager in the 80s. And so, of course, that was sort of ground zero for the slasher genre, Jason, Freddy, Michael Myers. And so some of those movies were kind of my initiation into some of the darker aspects of horror, and something that, you know, I've later been able to write about and sort of think about the meaning of. I mean, in a way, Tony, you know, I'm just such a horror nerd that I love it all.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I want to make clear this is a serious book, but it's a serious book written by sort of a serious nerd. That's really into this stuff, as well as thinks it's important for understanding American history, politics, culture, religion.
No, the book is absolutely fascinating. It is extremely well researched, and for me reading through it, it was a walk down memory lane through some of these movies that I used to watch, and I never got into the slasher genre too much. Again, I was more Radioactive Monsters, Things from Outer Space, but you know, being that you are deeply invested in this and your research and your own personal interest, if you had to recommend two or three great movies to watch this coming Halloween for people, what would you recommend? I mean, these could go back classic times or modern times.
Well, I'll tell you actually what my four Halloween movies are.
Okay, let's hear them.
These are essentially the movies that, you know, when I post trick-or-treating, I sit down to watch.
Mm-hmm.
Bride of Frankenstein, no surprise there,
mm-hmm.
from what I've already said. Nightmare on Elm Street, the original Nightmare on Elm Street, not any of the sequels. The sort of original Wes Craven vision, which is very interesting and very layered in all sorts of ways. The Exorcist, which not only is just a great film on its own terms, but I think is arguably the most frightening horror film ever made. And then finally, the original Halloween, John Carpenter's kind of original vision of unstoppable serial killer that is threat to the suburbs, and of course babysitters everywhere as well. But those are four not just really, really entertaining films, but very interesting films that you can enjoy on several different levels.
Yeah, and it's good that you mentioned the Halloween, the slasher film of attacking suburbia, because a lot of those themes, we think of it as Halloween as just a movie that's going to scare us, but there are these interesting subtexts to the movie where it's talking a lot about the American history of the time. And I came across your book at a political science convention of all places.
Okay.
Given that most of the political science convention was exceedingly boring, I was very excited to see this book at Baylor University Press and talking to the editor about it. And I said, oh man, I got to have this book on because it is really neat. And as I move through the book, at first I was expecting some a little lighthearted Frankenstein meets Abbott and Costello thing. But as I read through it, it really was a thought-provoking look at American history through the lens of the strange. And you start the book out with a warning to readers about what to expect, as we did here at the beginning of the podcast. But then you also start with this movie that I've never heard of before called Freaks, which is a film about people in a circus freak show that actually caused F. Scott Fitzgerald to run from the theater and vomit. And so in that respect, this book on monsters really does challenge us in thought-provoking ways, and that really spun my head around when I read that. But I also have to say you're a remarkable wordsmith in this, too, in that every sentence that you have in this book is really packed with a great deal of meaning and intention. So truly a great read here. But let me ask you this, because it is very dense, there's a lot of stuff going on here, and I want to ask, what did your book attempt to accomplish? And what, if there's one single thesis to come out of that book, what would it be?
I think absolutely the central argument is that American monsters are central to understanding American identity. That does not mean that I think, and I try to be very clear in the introduction what that doesn't mean.
Mm-hmm.
What that doesn't mean is that I simply see monsters as expressions of anxieties of different periods, which that's kind of been written about and done before.
Right.
I don't see them as, you know, symbolisms, metaphors of different kinds for different crises in American history. I actually think if you look down into sort of the root of American identity, the roots of the American experience, down there in that DNA, that sort of cultural DNA, there are monsters living there. And so what I do, you know, over really primarily from colonial period to the present, I mean, I even go back some to the very earliest settlement to Spanish and French settlement of quote-unquote New World. But what I really try to do in every period is talk about how, well, as one of my favorite theorists who I mentioned in the book, Zizek, Slavoj Zizek, says, fantasy scenarios tend to obscure the true horror of the situation. So the monster is more than metaphor. The monster is constructed by the very real horrors of history.
Let me ask you about that, and I want to probe you about this, and I've mm-hmm. tossed this around whether to put this at the end of the podcast or beginning, but we're talking about this, and you're mentioning that it's a read of history here, and so I want to bring up one of the more controversial aspects of your book.
Sure.
And it relates to the title of the book, Monsters in America.
Right.
And that this is a book that specifically addresses the United States from colonial beginnings in the 1600s. You have Cotton Mather in there, all the way up to the present.
Right.
And I want to read a passage of this book here.
Sure.
And get your reaction to this. Mm-hmm. This is on page, I'm going to flip it open here to page 24. It's reading about two paragraphs here. If the history of the American monster could be reduced to the story of psychic wounds opened by national traumas, then this would be strangely comforting. But the monsters walk among us, leaving a trail of gore and ichor in their wake. We wish we could be F. Scott Fitzgerald, having our uncomfortable encounters and then vomiting up our responses to them. It is not that simple. There are victims of our monsters, not victims screaming on the screen or within the pages of paperback horror fiction, but historical victims, sacrificed to the nation state and its sometimes bloodthirsty folk culture. The American past, this book contends, is a haunted house. Ghosts rattle their chains throughout its corridors, under its furniture, and in its small attic places. The historian must resurrect monsters in order to pull history's victims out of what Alice Walker called the mud of oblivion. The historian's task is necromancy, and it gives us nightmares. Or at least it should. The link between the metaphor and the reality of horror, the moments when monstrous fascinations become monstrous acts, appears far too often in American historical experience. Now, I want to ask, first of all, to what extent do you think your thesis is unique to the United States, or whether the tale that you tell is really generalizable to other nations and to humanity as a whole?
I think in a certain sense, it is a universal tale. I mean, every nation, and in fact, not only every nation, but every folk culture has had its monsters. And I think we're a scholar, and scholars who have looked at those have found, you know, a very similar kind of story. But, you know, at the same time, I think a historian, and this is part of the historian's task as well, you can't really afford to be a generalist. The study of history is, in part at least, the study of the particular. And so I really wanted to try to understand the American monster, and I wanted to do it in a possibly controversial way, because I felt like it would be sort of too easy to pivot and kind of say, well, you know, in comparison to other people's monsters, ours are not that terrible. I think that essentially sort of misses the question under consideration. I will say about that, though, if I could just add to that, I do think that there are some things peculiar to the American experience that make this study especially interesting, and that you wouldn't necessarily find in other kinds of historical and cultural context. And the main thing is that there is in American history, it's actually even kind of abroad currently in various kinds of political ideologies, there's this sort of deeply ingrained notion of American innocence. This sort of idea that you know, America was born in innocence, have always sort of been innocents abroad in different kinds of ways, and in at different points in our history, that notion has been stronger than others. At other times, it's taken a real beating. But I think it's always been kind of part of the way that America and Americans have tended to talk about themselves. And so I was a bit confrontational in certain kinds of ways in the book, in really sort of challenging that idea. What about the monsters in our closet? What about the monsters under our bed? What about the things that have happened in the darkest parts of the forest in American history?
Yeah, that does come out, and I think that is really challenging, and I think it is a good check upon our views or our mythic views sometimes that about American exceptionalism. And I'm a person who tends to share the vision of American exceptionalism, and it's not so much that it's the people per se who are different. And you use the term American innocence, and I think that's a very good term that you're working against, that we're somehow innocent in the world. We've done a lot of amazingly cruel things and horrible things to other individuals around us in that regard. So for me, the human beings that inhabit this country are not necessarily more or less fallible than anybody else, or I should say less fallible than anybody else. But the other side of the coin is I'm wondering to what extent we are more fallible, that we're more monstrous. And that, again, because you're focusing on America, you come off with this, at the end of the book, reading like, oh man, this is like, we're the most horrible country in the world here. And for me, the American exceptionalism is the institutional structures, and for me, I'm a political scientist, it's the institutional structures that open the ability for us to check and balance a lot of our more monstrous tendencies in. And I guess, too, one of the questions I have in the reading of some histories this way is, yeah, there's a lot of textbooks out there that celebrate American exceptionalism and innocence way too much to the extreme, that don't look at the blemishes and the warts and all the strange things that have gone on. But on the other hand, is it possible to oversimplify some of this just to see that, you know, America is nothing but exceptionally cruel?
Well, Tony, actually, I don't think that I would ever suggest that America is nothing but exceptionally cruel. I think that I did want to challenge certainly the idea of American exceptionalism. I mean, I do talk about that term in the book. I think it's a problematic idea. It's problematic in part because, of course, every society thinks that it's exceptional. And, you know, through world history, that has been the case.
We all have our myths, right?
Yeah. Right, exactly. We're all special. It's sort of another way to think about that. I don't, and I sort of fight shy, in fact, in the book of making comparisons over against other cultures. Not because there are not incredible cruelties, incredible historical cruelties in other kinds of historical contexts, but in part because part of sort of confrontation with the truth is a sort of a particularism, a decision to sort of face, to quote one of my favorite authors, William Burroughs, you know, what's the naked lunch? Well, it's that moment when everybody around the table realizes what's at the end of every fork. And sometimes that's a pretty disgusting, unhappy, and frightening experience.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also an encounter with the truth, and it's not really an encounter you get to have if you sort of are wondering what's going on at the other tables.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, let's take that as that, and let's go ahead and look at the perspective on American history through the lens of these monsters and such. And your book is historical in one sense, in that there is a rhythm to history here, but it's ahistorical in another sense, in that it's really looking at the past in some non-chronological ways, that certain themes tend to reoccur and are woven throughout our history here. Nonetheless, there are patterns, and I want to start with my era at first, the one that I mentioned at the outset of this, since I like space creatures and radioactive lizards. And for me, this is perhaps the easiest era to see the connection between the dominant monster tropes of the time and what was happening in that era. And what you talk about at the beginning, you talk about metaphors, that monsters are sometimes seen as metaphors for the anxieties of the time. And the theme of alien invasions and radioactive mutants was really prevalent in our post-World War II era, probably from the early 1950s through the mid to late 1960s. So what is going on in that era and with those monsters?
Well, the most common, and well, I guess I should say sort of the most popular film genre during the really the late 40s and throughout the 50s and, as you say, on into the 60s, is the alien invasion genre, and this idea of threats, a threat of some kind that comes in from the outside, and it may be this sort of outright military invasion, or as in things like Invasion of the Body Snatchers, the original thing from another world, Howard Hawks, it's this kind of invasion from within. Your neighbors are not really your neighbors. They're actually these alien subversives. And, you know, for me, that is a pretty clear reflection of what's going on in the beginnings of the Cold War. Fears of invasion by the Soviet Union, fears of atomic destruction, which were tamped down in certain ways in the 1950s. There was this real effort to try to be optimistic. It was really hard to be optimistic when you're on the brink of the apocalypse. And then all of these warnings that, you know, communists are subverting us from within. You know, I quote J. Edgar Hoover in the book as talking about, you know, keep an eye on your neighbors. Be suspicious of the woman next door if she seems especially interested in educational issues. She might be a member of the Communist Party. Beware of young people who play guitars. I mean, I'm not making this up. I mean, this is
it's well documented.
Literally, sort of Hoover's, you know, warnings. And so, you know, that's finding reflection in things like, well, the pod people, the aliens are already among us. So, I think this is sort of symptomatic and kind of intertwined with this idea of a society under threat.
Now, that's not the only thing that is going on during that era. And as I read through the book, and again, it has a chronological nature to it, but it also a non-chronological aspect. There's certain other patterns that come up. And one thing that really caught me by surprise, and I guess I wasn't necessarily aware of this at the time because I was more interested in giant lizards. And again, not you know, you make a very good point too, that you know kids don't be worried about the nuclear war coming from the Soviet Union. What you have to really be worried about is this giant butterfly that's been affected by radioactive fallout from an atoll in the Pacific.
Right.
Okay, that's a little bit easier for me to grasp. But one of the other themes that emerges during the post-war era and persists, I think, until present day, and may even go deeper back in American history, is this idea of deviant bodies.
Mm-hmm.
And you start the chapter, which you entitled Deviant Bodies, with the Hitchcock drama Psycho.
Right, 1960.
Yeah, and everybody gets that one. That's a little bit different movie than Invasions from Without or Invasions from Within. It's a different theme there. And then you quickly go to something that I didn't know about, a famous comic book series called Tales from the Crypt. I knew that was made to a TV show later, but it was, I think, a spinoff of DC Comics. It was Entertaining Comics or something like that.
Yeah, a little breakaway company from DC originally, that by the 1950s. Was producing mainly horror comics, what we would think of as horror comics, a lot of them connected to crime, murder, particularly murder within the household.
And that's what you presented at. And as I thought about that, I said, that's really an interesting theme. It's a what we would call, or I think you term it too, is a human agency horror. That it's not a radioactive beast, it's not something from outer space completely unknown, but this is us where the average person, something is different. So
right.
what is about this theme, and what is it telling us about American history at that time and up to present?
Well, one of the things, and you know, this is not new to historians really, but I think it may be new to a larger audience that reads the book, is that the 1950s are not a simple kind of period.
It's not Happy Days and Fonzie?
It's not simply Happy Days. Mm-hmm. We sort of know it wasn't Leave It to Beaver,
mm-hmm.
but also people at the time knew it wasn't all about Leave It to Beaver. there is kind of this other 50s. There's actually even this great collection of essays called The Other 50s that explores sort of the dissident, the subversive. I mentioned Burroughs a minute ago. I mean, he's a product of the 50s. So EC was very much a part of that. These were comics that, kids were reading, also adults were reading. One thing many people don't realize is that in the 40s and 50s, up until at least the coming of the Comics Code, probably as many adults as kids were reading comic books. In fact, it's a lot more like today than the 60s, the 60s and 70s and the early 80s were. So, EC Comics, these very macabre horror comics that often dealt with sort of domestic, what you could call domestic horrors, the murder of spouses, often in the most bizarre and kind of, to be frank, sort of darkly hilarious kinds of ways imaginable.
Yeah, it does have those blends of very darkness to it, but the comic book format itself lends it to a cartoonish type of figure, and that juxtaposition is very interesting.
Right, and I'll mention too, one of the things about EC is they tended to be very subversive all the way around, and almost had a kind of a political and a politically and culturally subversive intent. What I mean by that is that frequently, the comics featured stories in which, pre Betty Friedan, pre Feminine Mystique, women were taking, housewives in particular, took these sort of terrible, macabre vengeances on their husbands. Children got back at parents. Inmates of mental institutions sort of took revenge on what was presented as, their very cruel supervisors and doctors and overseers. And by the way, the 1950s was also the great age of institutionalization
mm-hmm.
in American life, and so that was very timely. And then, at the same time, EC was producing sort of quasi-historical comics that often sort of turned American icons on their head. They produced a really controversial version of the story of George Armstrong Custer, who was still, we don't think of him this way today, I don't think, but in the 1950s he was still seen as kind of this icon, this kind of martyr to the opening of the West. And EC Comics presents him as this sort of murderous fool, actually, who gets himself and his men killed while on this mission that he shouldn't have been on anyway. So EC is kind of, some pretty good evidence that there's a lot more going on in the 50s than Fonzie hitting the jukebox and all the kind of images we tend to connect with that era.
Yeah, when I was reading that chapter, I kept thinking Stepford Wives, which I think was
sure.
written maybe in the early 60s. I don't think it became a movie until later.
Much later, right.
But it does have that interesting quality to it. And that actually, that's one movie that you didn't mention in there, Stepford Wives. And that...
I didn't. I certainly could have, because you're right. But it sort of fits into, especially a lot of my discussion about the late 20th century, about, you know, certain things look very clean, look very nice, look very sanitized. You look beneath the surface a little bit, and there's some, you know, there's some pretty gruesome stuff going on.
The other thing that came up during this period of time, the 1950s, and again, this is, we got radioactive monsters on one hand. That's the world I walk in.
Right.
Then you have the EC Comics, which I'm sure my parents kept from me, being good parents that they were. But there was this other theme about serial killers, and that gets a little bit to Psycho. Psycho was just, well, actually, Psycho was a lot of a perpetual murder, I guess, to think about it. It's kind of a strange way, but the issue of serial killers comes up, and this keeps going through in the 1970s. It really picks up a little bit more theme. So
right.
What do serial killers and the dramas like that tell us about us?
Well, as you say, it's kind of around the late 50s with Psycho, also the country becoming aware of Ed Gein, who in the late 1950s becomes the first well-known serial killer that there's a lot of popular fascination with. But then, you know, what I really get interested in is in the 1980s, when you have the birth of, you know, what I've described as a kind of a serial killer celebrity culture. This fascination that finds expression in true crime books, the whole true crime genre, in fact, that seems to have been really born during that era. And then also, very oddly and very unfortunately, a real focus from official sources, from the Federal Bureau of Investigation, for example, on the serial killer as a real and present threat to Americans and to American life, even though, as I, you know, there's some statistics in the book where I talk about that, you know, we're talking about actually a very, very, very tiny percentage of homicides in the United States were stranger killings, as they used to be called, or serial murder, as they became known. And yet, I think most Americans in the 80s and 90s, both because of some things that official sources were saying, also because of some of our fictions, some of our films, Silence of the Lambs most prominently, there's this sense that there were these sort of, you know, these murdering maniacs were everywhere, that anybody could become a threat, when in fact we know that most of the victims of most serial killers were very marginalized people in different ways, homeless people, prostitutes. Others. And so it was not a threat that most Americans had to be concerned about, yet it was one that they were fascinated with and were told that they needed to worry about.
And it's parallels, too, I think, with the child abduction scares that you
Absolutely.
See during this period of time. And I've talked to Bradley Wright about trends
right.
in American history. And if you look through the 1980s and 1990s, the number of child abductions is dropping dramatically. Yet,
right.
the stories of this and the stories of serial killers are in the news all the time. So we have this disproportionate view of what is actually going on. And for me, it almost seems that the news, and this is at the time when cable news is starting to take off, the 1980s and 1990s, the 24-hour news cycle becomes
right.
important. It almost becomes that the news becomes our horror story. It becomes our way to look at monster movies in that regard. And thoughts on that?
I absolutely agree with that, and in fact, my sense is that by the time of the 1990s, well, really, I mean, you know, starting in the late 60s with the beginnings of satellite technology, you've got all these multiple channels. You've got entrepreneurs like Murdoch who emerge in this period, Rupert Murdoch. You know, they really create these kind of webs of media outlets that include things like magazine, radio, newspaper, eventually the internet. And so suddenly, you know, we go from three networks to there's suddenly thousands of outlets, and all of it, you know, very hungry for content. And so it becomes a kind of a perfect storm sort of situation. I talk about how, you know, part of what's going on is this kind of counter-revolution, this sort of sexual counter-revolution, I call it, this kind of response in the 1980s to some of the changes of the 60s and 70s, changes in family life, changes in traditionalist attitudes towards marriage. There's a real backlash against that. And the serial killer, who often is represented as a sexual deviant as well as a murderer, in many ways becomes kind of a symbol of how people are very nervous about those kinds of changes.
That the changes that we wrought in the 60s and 70s are now out of control and are coming back to haunt us in some respect.
Right, and in fact, you have some commentators who literally say, you know, we created the serial killer. The serial killer is almost a kind of reaping of what we sowed. And you have very popular true crime authors, people like Susan Rule, who wrote the first book about Ted Bundy, this very popular book about Ted Bundy in the 80s, who emphasized things like, well, Bundy became a serial killer because he was raised by a single mother. Or a lot of emphasis on this idea that, well, Jeffrey Dahmer, you know, he's a cannibal, but he's also gay. So, you know, commentators, particularly conservative commentators, really found in the serial killer this kind of metonym for everything that they did not like that had happened since the 1960s.
Yeah, we see that repeatedly. We oftentimes look for, you know, signs of punishment for sins that we may be creating throughout history. And again, you pick up these different aspects of history or just events, the Ted Bundys of the world or whatever, which are very, very small slivers of life, but then they become expanded in ways that, yes, this is punishment for our sins in that regard.
Right.
I want to turn back now before, because we're getting close to the contemporary period here, the first decade of the 21st century, and I want to leave some of the monsters in that era or that we're developing for a little bit later. So now, in a, again, non-chronological way, I'm going to transport us backwards in time to the historical beginnings of the United States here. And could you tell us a little bit about the monsters of the colonial period? Because I don't think many people would realize that there are that many monsters back there. Well, you might think about the witch trials, but
right,
there's some other stuff going on. So
right,
give us a sense of the 1600s.
No, that's actually a great question. You know, often when folks hear about, you know, sort of what I've written about, the very first thing they say is, oh, you mean the Salem witches? which, you know, certainly I talk about the witch and the image of the witch, but there's a lot more going on in the colonial era. For one thing, you know, I look at a number of 16th and 17th century explorers' accounts, both French and Spanish explorers' accounts, who often assumed the existence of monsters in the New World, some of whom were drawing on older mythologies about monstrous races that populated the rest of the globe. This had always been an important part of European mythology, although they wouldn't have called it mythology. They thought of it as sort of, you know, speculative natural history.
Mm-hmm.
This is the kind of stuff that is out beyond the borders of what we know. Here's what we should expect that we're going to encounter. And then the native peoples themselves, both from the writings of early explorers, or really, rather, I should say, writings allegedly based on the experiences of early explorers, and also some of the things that the Puritans, particularly Puritan ministers, had to say, the native peoples are pictured as a monstrous race. There's particularly a fascination with the idea of cannibalism. cannibalism, which of course is a practice not unknown in the New World and in other parts of the world, but quite uncommon. and yet, in 16th and 17th century accounts, you get the sense that the New World is sort of full of cannibals, and even the book actually even includes some illustrations from that period that present this.
Well, in part, one could kind of get an image of this, because in one of the areas where cannibalism was practiced was the Caribbean. I think the Caribs were at the time expanding around, 1492, 1493, and so, Columbus lands, sees this stuff, and is like, whoa, what is going on here? And again, it's a small slice, but then it takes on a more larger trope in and of itself.
Right. Among the Machica, among the Aztecs, among other Caribbean groups, where you may have had cannibalism, it actually wasn't something. It was actually something that was often reserved for a sort of a priestly elite, and was this sort of ritual practice. But it sort of becomes representative for Europeans of what they're expecting to find everywhere. And the Puritans, even though, now we're talking about a really different generation of explorers, we're talking about, the Protestant entry into the New World, they sort of bring kind of their own monstrous mythologies where, the Indians, according to Cotton Mather, are the children of the devil. And he meant that quite literally, that they were a race separate from the race created by God and brought to the New World as a specific threat and a specific temptation to the Puritan people. So monsters everywhere in in New World mythologies.
One of the things that you mentioned, I don't know, Cotton Mather has come up a couple times on this podcast when we've dealt with colonial history, but one thing I didn't know about him was he discovered a fossilized tooth of a mastodon or dinosaur or something like that, right? And that becomes a big piece of proof for the monstrous nature of the New World.
Yes. Yeah, and that actually brings us into the 18th century, actually, and a major, one of the earliest scientific controversies in America. What were the meaning of some of these fossils that were being discovered, many of which we know now were the woolly mammoth, which was native to North America in prehistoric times. And there was a real debate about what they meant. According to Cotton Mather, well, these are the giants discussed in the Hebrew Bible. These are the Nephilim mentioned in Genesis chapter 6. And Mather had his supporters, non-Puritan supporters. Ezra Stiles, who was president of Yale University, a clergyman who was president of Yale University, agreed with Mather, at least at first, this confirms the Bible. Not surprisingly, Thomas Jefferson had a different view. He did not think this was the case. He thought that this was an interesting and natural animal, although what's interesting about that is that even Jefferson wanted it to be a kind of a monster. He gets into this debate with French natural scientists about whether or not the atmosphere, the soil of the New World is sort of fertile enough to produce mighty monsters. And Jefferson was convinced that it was. So I do get in to a good bit of sort of the early debates in science, how monsters figured into sort of even the professionalization of science in the 19th century.
What is your read on witches? I mean, that's the one thing everybody thinks about, the Puritan New England witch trials, Salem witch trials. What's your read on that?
Well, the segment of the book, as you know, that talks about that is called Sex with the Devil. In certain respects, that really kind of sums up what I think was going on with the image of the witch. And I'm not the first to suggest that. Carol Carlson, who wrote this wonderful book, The Devil in the Shape of a Woman, suggested that gender and sexuality and sort of fear of women's growing economic power and women's sexuality was kind of at the heart of the witch craze, and at kind of the heart of the image of the witch. And I certainly think that was significant. I also go out beyond New England, however.
Yes.
The witch trials were a broader phenomenon than just New England. And, in fact, slaves, particularly slaves suspected of taking part in rebellion, were sometimes accused of what was called conjuration, taking part in various kinds of demonic practices, including the poisoning of masters, which was seen as a kind of witchcraft because, you know, it involved the making of potions, essentially.
And let's talk a little bit more about that, because slavery is a big component of the book here, and how that figures into the monstrous portrayals of African Americans, of the other, in not only the colonial period, but up through the Civil War and beyond that time. And I think that, in historical terms, that's one of your areas of expertise, the postbellum and antebellum South. So tell us a little bit about how monsters connect with slavery.
Well, I spent some time with the connections between the monstrous and the Atlantic slave trade, because I think it's actually very key to understanding why that happened and how what was happening was understood, not just by the slave traders and the merchant class and the planters, but actually by enslaved people themselves. I talked about monstrous races. There was kind of this mythology that develops, beginning with the first European-African encounters in the 15th century, that African people were connected to monstrous races in different ways. In fact, all sorts of mythologies about crossbreeding taking place between African men and the gorilla, which was a new monster for the Europeans as well. And so what I argue is that, in part, in the European need, particularly the English need, which, since the English were not really familiar, they had not really practiced slavery before this point, before the 16th and 17th century, there was this need to legitimize that. And if you make another people monstrous, if you essentially rob them of their humanity symbolically, then it becomes possible to rob them of their humanity literally, to enslave them. Then, you know, from the other side, I talk about the fact that for the African people being enslaved, there was this sense that they were encountering monsters. And there's this monstrous mythology that develops that, you know, who are these whites who are trading in human beings? Well, interestingly, they are cannibals. What's happening to the people who are disappearing? Well, they're eating them. Stories among slaves in Louisiana that the wine that they saw when they first arrived, when they saw their masters drinking wine, that their masters were essentially vampire-like creatures who were drinking the blood of other slaves. It's really, you know, the slave trade is a world of terror, and tied in with that is this whole mythos of terror. And this whole sort of story of monsters that continues on into the 19th century.
And speaking of the 19th century, too, you talk about westward expansion, and this was another aspect of the book that kind of jumped out at me. I was surprising that thinking about as we move west, and I'm not talking west, Wyoming west, but I'm talking west as in Kentucky.
Right.
Daniel Boone kind of west.
Absolutely. Yeah.
There's frontier monsters, especially this little practice, and I didn't know anything about this. You need to explain this to people, something called noodling. what is that?
Well, noodling is still around.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I use for my my source for some of this fairly recent book called Noodling for Flatheads, which tells about this sort of practice where men show their masculinity in places like rural Missouri, rural Kentucky, by sticking their arms kind of up to their elbows, down in these kind of deep pools where often quite large catfish are sort of settled in. And the fish will actually clamp down around the arm. And when that happens, the noodler, the fisherman, jerks this fish out of the water. And it's actually apparently a point of pride to kind of show off, you know, these enormous scars and near dismemberment that sometimes results from this. And so in that section of the book, I actually start off talking about that actually really old practice. I mean, it goes back to frontier days, even though you still find it, to kind of suggest that part of what's going on the frontier is there's this fear of monsters combined with this need to confront the monster. This idea that, you know, being an American frontiersman, a man, is in part confronting these horrible things that may be out there. And there are all sorts of stories about giant fish, which is kind of a favorite, lake monsters of various kinds. Even some of the stories that enter into American folklore about giant bears, other kinds of things that actually would later have some influence on the Bigfoot stories, would kind of fit into this American monster, frontier monster kind of idea. Jefferson actually suggested to Lewis and Clark that they keep an eye out for monstrous creatures. Jefferson, while he wouldn't have gone along with Mather, obviously, about these being giants from the Bible, he was convinced that there were some extraordinary creatures out there on the American frontier that just simply hadn't been encountered yet.
Yeah, and eventually they do run into the buffalo, which are, you know,
right.
both frightening when you first see a buffalo,
absolutely.
But also awe-inspiring in some
right.
regards.
Absolutely.
And that has, and the Taming of the West theme, too, I thought was very interesting, is that not only do we see these monsters, but we need to confront the monsters and conquer the monsters. And now, speaking of big fish, this was a surprise for me that Moby Dick appeared in the book. It was a chapter in the chapter on Gothic America, and I never thought of Herman Melville's classic whale hunting story as one of monsters. But you do make this case, and set it into the larger context of sea serpents.
Well, you know, I've, to my own surprise, actually, one of the first things I discovered when I started studying this topic is that the sea serpent was really America's favorite monster for much of the 19th century.
See, that's why I like Godzilla so much.
Right, there you
yeah,
go.
Yeah,
see,
I'm just in
American,
tune with American history.
Even though it's a Japanese film.
That's true.
Originally.
Yeah.
This fascination with these sort of, you know, giant creatures from the sea.
I do have to butt in here, though. Even though it was a Japanese film and had the guy who played Ironside, Perry Mason, I forgot his name.
Was that in the Americanized version?
I thought the original Japanese black and white Godzilla version had the Perry Mason guy in it. I can't remember his name.
Well, I may have just learned something.
Yeah. We'll have to hit IMDb about that and check
we'll
that out.
We'll have to check into that.
But anyway, tell us about Moby Dick and sea serpents.
Yeah. Well, you know, the sea serpent shows up in pop culture in the 19th century. You know, there's actually this popular piece of sheet music that I talk about in the 1850s called the Sea Serpent Polka. Ships were named Sea Serpent. It was a favorite name for captains to give to their ships. And many people, including many in the scientific community, were convinced of their reality. Sea serpent sightings were quite common, both by landlubbers and also by whalers. And in fact, that's actually how I sort of transitioned from a discussion of this into Moby Dick, because I think it's important to remember that part of the new American frontier in the 19th century was the sea. Particularly for whalers, and you know, Moby Dick, Melville's Moby Dick, is a novel that, while not important in the 19th century, actually wasn't very popular in the 19th century. Later, comes to be seen as this really important meditation on kind of the meaning of America, And what I was struck when I read it again recently, I actually was reading Moby Dick while I was writing Monsters in America, was the amount of horrific imagery. I mean, literally the imagery of horror that makes its way into the book, and that in some ways I think actually makes Melville kind of the ancestor of H.P. Lovecraft in certain kinds of respects. The way that he talks about the murderous fish, the way that he describes monstrous cannibals and savages who use hacking and horrifying implements, the way that he describes a scene when Ishmael walks into the Spouter's End for the first time, which is kind of his hangout for local whalers, and what he sees is kind of this picture hanging that he talks about as being a representation of cloudy darkness that goes back to the time of the New England hags. So, you know, this reference to back to the witch trials, and yet it's actually a scene out on the sea. It's a scene of whale hunting. And then also just the amount of gore in Moby Dick. I mean, part of the detailed descriptions that Melville gives of the Pequod is that, you know, it's kind of this factory of death. It's this factory of dismemberment, and goes into quite a lot of detail with that. So Moby Dick is as a horror tale in many ways, while at the same time being a meditation on American experience.
Yeah, that was one of the most interesting and eye-opening passages in the book to really think about that. Because again, as a high school student forced to read Moby Dick, I was like, okay, yeah, white whale, chelly hunting, blah blah blah.
Right.
Maybe I have to go back and read it again in light of this book. And so that might be some homework for my listeners here as well to do that. You situate Moby Dick in terms of Gothic America, and you have a chapter on that. And briefly tell us what's going on here, because this Gothic America, it's interesting and, again, recalls a lot of things I hadn't thought about or hadn't remembered. But you take us back from the legend of Sleepy Hollow, Ichabod Crane, and then all the way up through Edgar Allan Poe and possibly even into today. This is one of these big themes. Gothic America, Gothic Americana runs throughout our entire history. So what is Gothic Americana telling us about ourselves?
Well, it's really this idea that, in a way, you're right. I think it is a theme that runs through the book. This idea of the shadow side to sort of American sunny optimism, and of course, the 19th century was a century of optimism, at least up until about 1850, 1860. There was this sense of expanding nation, expanding markets, the market revolution. These are go-ahead times, newspapermen were saying, until they stopped being go-ahead times, and there was an economic bust followed by another boom. And in this chapter, though, I talk about these sort of underground elements that are happening at the same time that I'm not sure everyone was really aware of. Well, I guess I know that they weren't, that, you know, people like Poe, people like Hawthorne, people like Melville were sort of pointing out this darkness on the edge of town, this stuff that is being missed. And so I suggest that in Melville, for instance, you get almost this kind of this sort of presaging of the American Civil War, some sort of clear images, and we certainly know that he was keeping up with the news in the 1850s and is sort of aware of these sort of lengthening shadows. And then when the Civil War itself comes, sort of describe how in the aftermath there's this real effort. Now there's two very opposite tendencies that develop. On the one hand, there's this effort to sort of sentimentalize death. We get during this period the growth of the funeral industry. For example, undertakers are no longer undertakers, they're funeral directors. Coffins aren't coffins anymore, they're called caskets, you know, where you keep your jewels, in other words. At the same time, you've got a developing fascination with gore. with the dismemberment of the body, and the idea that that can be a kind of entertainment. And I actually try to look at Matthew Brady's photographs, his famous Civil War photographs, from that perspective. These posed photographs of corpses,
mm-hmm.
that became very popular. That in fact Congress made the sort of official photographic record of the American Civil War. And I think it's no accident that by the late 19th century, we have the first glimmers, sort of dark glimmers, of our fascination with the serial killer. Americans are probably more interested in Jack the Ripper than Londoners were in the 1880s and the 1890s. Again, it's sort of this theme that I play with throughout, where you've got this sort of sunny optimism, this kind of daylight world that Americans think they're living in, with darker shadows that are kind of gathering all around.
The theme of the gore and the dismemberment of the body and funerals also leads us into another genre of the horror film, which takes off in the early 20th century. And this is a chapter that you called Weird Science, where technological progress or scientific progress is really making leaps and bounds in the late 1800s, early 1900s. And we start to look at a darker side of the science. Science can free us from a lot of the previous difficulties we've had with life, but on the other hand, you get Frankenstein.
Right.
So what is weird science?
Well, what I tried to do there is really sort of examine the relationship between the idea of the medicalization of the body, the idea that the body could be studied, understood, even improved in certain kinds of ways, and how that in the late 19th and then into the 20th century really intersects with the American tradition, yeah, I'm afraid you have to call it, of racism. So that you get what scholars call, in quotes of course, scientific racism.
Eugenics.
This conception of certain races being degenerate in certain kinds of ways, of the cranium actually being either smaller or distorted in non-Anglo-Saxon races. All these ideas that we know today had no basis in science, but were presented as scientific ideas. Really, a sort of scientific rendering of the monstrous, a kind of a new version of the European mythologies of monstrous races. And I think it's no accident that we're sort of talking about the same period where there's a fascination with the sideshow, with the freak show, in fact, which was often presented as this sort of representation of the human body reimagined and reimagined in a dark, inferior kind of way. It's the period when that sort of thing is most popular. This is also the period of lynching in America, the post Civil War rise of lynching of primarily African American men, who tended to be imagined as sort of these criminal beasts. Often, as I point out several times, actually using some of the language of Mary Shelley. Newspaper editors and others talk about African-American men as if they are Frankenstein's monster on the loose. And it becomes this legitimation for this incredible violence.
There's also the aspects of science out of control, the Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde aspect to this. And for me, this is interesting, and this is going to kind of jettison us up to the present period. And with the few minutes we have remaining, I do want to talk about the contemporary period, because one thing that I noted, and I think this is a very interesting tension for me in American history, is back in the 1950s and 60s, when I was watching a lot of these movies, many of them in syndication in the 70s, you had the atomic monster. But starting in the 90s, we start to see not radioactive large monsters, but small microbial monsters.
Right.
And it's a biological threat, and it's a scientific. Again, you could think of the nuclear monsters as a scientific threat, but what for me is fascinating, and recently the movie Contagion came out, where we're being attacked by little bugs here, is we have an awe and a reverence for science, but on the other hand, we're deathly afraid of it and of what it can potentially unleash. So what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that the fear of science out of control, you know, we almost don't have the mad scientist anymore. We have mad science. It's sort of like it's scarier than there's human agency involved. It's kind of acting on its own. So many of our fictions that we could point to, whether you're talking about the Terminator franchise in the 1990s, the recent Rise of the Planet of the Apes has a similar kind of theme, Contagion and other kinds of, you know, other kinds of disease fear, microbe fear, hot zone, and other kinds of nonfiction and fictional representations of this thing. This seems to be what's on the horizon for what's going to scare us. I talk about our new monster, in other words. I mean, I talk about sort of post-human fears at the end of the book, and that takes in a lot of different kinds of things. It's an apocalyptic fear, but it's an apocalyptic fear tied in with the idea that science is no longer manageable, and that the natural world is simply not as manageable as we think that it is. And that it's essentially going to get us. I think, you know, you could even point to things like the popularity of the History Channel series Life After People.
Right, right.
Which kind of imagines, okay, let's at some point maybe human beings, likely human beings, are going to be subtracted from the equation. What's the world going to look like? You know, I think this is on the horizon and in terms of sort of our next monsters. I would add, actually, I've been thinking recently that I think we have to kind of consider our fears of the digital frontier in this and sort of digital monsters in different kinds of ways.
Yeah, the Terminator has that theme, is that the machines take over.
The machines take over, and also sort of the idea that we could give ourselves to the machines in a certain kind of way. I mean, I'm wondering, for example, if in the next decade we're going to see more and more horror narratives that relate to social media and sort of social media out of control, where human beings lose their humanity in some essential way and they just become kind of these internet constructs.
Yeah, there's been a couple films that regard. I mean, I'm thinking there was a Bruce Willis film that wasn't all that good, where he lives in an internet world but then has to come out of that body to solve a crime. And then there was the one, I forgot, where the computer is watching you everywhere you go, and you can't figure out how they know what's going to happen next to you because the computer has programmed that.
Right, and I what comes to mind for me is the really good film Source Code, Duncan Jones' Source Code, where you've got this American soldier who is essentially dead, but has become kind of a data stream that is kept alive and is sort of forced to continue to be an instrument of the national security state. and in fact, they won't let him die. He's just sort of living as this digitized construct. And it's a terrifying thought. And it may be sort of, you know, our next monster.
You know, speaking of our next monsters, I want you to just reflect upon the last decade or so of our monsters and reading your book and thinking about our culture as it tells us something about our world today. It seems like every type of monster is converging here in the last decade. You got the vampires, you got the zombies, you got the weird science, you got a lot of the gothic culture is still there. The serial killer slasher movies are coming back again, or if they've ever went away. I think we're on Halloween 18, and we're actually remaking the original Halloween because we're run out of of sequels and numbers for sequels that we're just going to start at one again. So what were your thoughts about where are we today with monsters? And is it all coming together? Or are we at the doom and the apocalypse? 2012 is around the corner, after all. so what thoughts?
Well, you know, the last great golden age, really the golden age of monsters, as I mentioned before, was the 1930s. I mean, other than gangster movies, monster movies were the most popular. Today, you know, I actually would say that in the last, I think maybe decade to 15 years, there's actually been this kind of renaissance of horror. And part of what that has meant is that all kinds of subgenres, as you suggest, have really flourished, and we've even kind of seen some new ones. I think that part of that might be because we as a society are really terrified. We are in the midst of a very serious economic crisis that some indicators suggest may get worse. Combined with our you know, very necessary nervousness over terrorism, are some of our emerging ethical debates over everything from cloning to robotics. For that reason, I think that we have become a very fearful society. And I think that for that reason, you have all kinds of monster narratives flourishing. And of course, it is interesting to me, and I do talk about this some in the book, just how important the idea of the zombie apocalypse has become. And this kind of anxiety that, honestly, it just shows no signs of becoming less popular. And at the same time, it's a kind of narrative that a lot of people turn to for fun and for sort of an escape from, you know, the possibility of very real kinds of apocalypses. So, you know, in a sense, as much as a horror nerd as I am, I think it's sort of unfortunate that this is a kind of new golden age for horror, because it really reflects some of the real horrors that we're facing.
And both you and I have that shared interest in these movies and that different types of monsters in the past. And yes, as you're talking about this, I could see the zombie apocalypse as being a nervous laughter of our society.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
That, yeah, this is all silly and goofy, and we manage it in different ways. But the undercurrent is, yeah, we're a little bit worried about things. And maybe it's a fear that human beings have had for a very long time. It just manifests in different ways. I'm going to ask you one last question here,
sure.
And this might be the tough question for you.
Okay.
Because we talked about the gloominess or the darkness or the macabre nature of American history. Do you see any redeeming characteristics in American history? And through your studies of this, have some redeeming quality of America come through for you?
Well, I have to say, I'm obviously as a historian, I'm sort of utterly fascinated with the American experience in general, and I guess I would call myself a sort of a Woody Guthrie, Carl Sandburg patriot. I don't have very much use for the United States as an institution. Certainly not as an idea about innocence, certainly not as a symbol for sort of autonomous, possessive individualism, which seems to be what many people mean when they say they're a patriot. But the idea that the culture of the American people, there's some interesting and meaningful things. And so, you know, as gloomy as the book is, it's nice also in the book to get to revisit things like, like Frederick Douglass, who, for example, had this fascinating rhetoric about slavery and monsters that I explore in the book. To look at American movements again, like the civil rights struggle. And, other things that sort of show the best of us. At the same time, I mean, I feel like if I'm in the book kind of the storyteller with everybody around the campfire, I've got a scary story to tell. It's not an optimistic story, and it's not a story meant to make you sleep good. I want to give my readers nightmares in certain kinds of ways, and so, that's part of my sort of warning to the reader when they pick the book up.
And I think that is a very good warning to have. And for those of you who do want to delve into history in a haunting manner, I recommend that you pick up Monsters in America, Our Historical Obsession with the Hideous and the Haunting by Scott Poole. Scott's been our guest today on Research on Religion, and I want to thank you for being with us.
Thanks. I enjoy it very much. Great conversation.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.